Hello, this is Doug Hadaway. Welcome to Achieve Great Things, where we talk about the power of strategy, science, and storytelling to help you achieve ambitious goals for people on the planet.
What makes someone influential? What qualities do people see in compelling communicators and charismatic leaders? At a time when many people seem to be losing faith in institutions, what can leaders do to build trust and win people's confidence? On this episode of Achieve Great Things, we'll explore these questions with John Neffinger. He co-authored a book that's required reading at Harvard, Columbia, and other business schools around the world. It's called Compelling People. It's full of scientific insights and practical skills you can use to be a more compelling speaker and a more influential leader. John Neffinger, welcome to Achieve Great Things, and congratulations on 10 years of Compelling People.
Wow. Thank you, Doug. Now look at that. There it is. There it is. Oh, you have the original cover. How about that? What do they call this, man? Playmobil people, or actually the bathroom signs, I guess. But anyhow, yes, no, thank you. It's great to be here, Doug.
Let's start with a story from the book. You have lots of examples of people most of us have heard of who are compelling people. What's an example of a compelling person from the book, and what makes them compelling?
I always kind of want to go right to the top, which is, in this business, Oprah, who did not come from anything particular to get her to the top and all the places that she went, and really does kind of exude all of the things that we're talking about, which is to say, this is somebody who is friendly and engaging and understands us in a deep way. But then also, who is that guy that, remember the Thousand Little Pieces thing, who she kind of took to the woodshed after it turned out that his Book of the Month Club book was full of, let's just say it was fiction instead of nonfiction. She can be hard on you when she wants to be hard. You don't want to cross her. You don't want to. So this is somebody who has both the build you up and support you in your time of need and can do all of those things, but can also be stern when she needs to. She's got that range. She's got both of those things going on. And, you know, I guess it helps. Nowadays, I think we think of her as giving away cars to everybody, which, you know, that will make you popular. But that's not what got her there. What got her there was her demeanor, that this was a person who really did care, but was also going to hold you accountable at the same time.
So in the book, you talk about that as a combination of two sort of domains of personal traits, strength and warmth. Tell us about strength and warmth.
Sure. So that's exactly it. When you're sizing somebody up, when you're having that, whether it's in the first few milliseconds or over a long relationship, when you're having that emotional reaction, your takeaway for somebody, how do they make you feel? It's based on two separate things that are interrelated in an interesting way. So the first is what we call strength. And that is the ability someone has to make things happen, get things done. That could be because they're physically strong, but it's not really about, you know, how much you can bench press. It's your ability to operate in the world. And so it could be money and power, but it's also your personality. Is this somebody who we're going to listen to and is going to be able to get their way and impose their will on the world around them? So that's the strength piece. And the idea is just, if somebody seems like they're going to, through whatever combination of factors, have their way in the world and get things done, we have to respect that fact because this is a person who is in our world. And so we respect that ability, but we don't always have to like it, which is the other piece of this, which is the warmth. Are they on our team? Is there affinity there? Are they our kind of person? Are they personable? Do we have a personal connection, or do they just sort of seem like our kind of people? And so it's this getting it done strength and the attachment or empathy or sympathy that we feel from that for them, warmth piece, that are our two factors that add up to the kind of gut level emotional sense that we get when we react to somebody.
And you mentioned that we size them up. And I remember this, the origins of the science comes from sort of evolutionary psychology and how people survived by learning to quickly instantly make judgments about others. Tell us about that science.
You can think of those judgments in shorthand as a fight or flight on the strength side, right? Is this somebody who's going to beat me up? and I need to get out of here, or is this somebody I can stay and fight and I'll do just fine? But that's only after, in a sense, and there's some debate about which judgment comes first, but that's a separate judgment from the friend or foe, which is the warmth. Is this person on my team or not? So friend or foe, fight or flight. And if, yeah, if you want to do the evolutionary biology hypothetical, if we're, Neanderthals or whatever, old timey tribal living pre-human humanoids, if somebody new shows up, those are the two things you most urgently need to know. Are they on my side or not? And can I take them if I have to, right? Because those are really basic safety issues for you surviving in the great big pre-civilization world. And so our brains are full of circuitry that make those assessments kind of automatically super quick.
And fast forward to 20th century, some political scientists were studying how people choose presidents, and they lo and behold see these coming up. And it wasn't assessing the policy agenda and looking at their resume, it was sizing them up as a person.
That's right. And I think the way I like to think about this, Doug, is I mean, I have a law degree that I didn't do that much with, but I got it. And like, so I like to think about policies and white papers and all that kind of conceptual stuff. But most people who feel less familiar or less comfortable making those kind of judgments and arguments still feel really confident about the thing that they do all the time, which is size people up. And so they trust their own version of people and their own knack for that. And they come with, we're all born with all the circuitry to do that. And so it's that sizing people up process that really has a lot to do with where people come down at the end of the day. And if you think about that in terms of a leader, especially not just looking for a friend or, you know, somebody to spend your time with, but a leader of a community, right? The thing we want in a leader is somebody who fights for us, right? Who stands up, but is not a tyrant. It's not like super strong and not interested in our interests. Strong enough to get it done, all the things the community needs, but very much on behalf of the community. And so those qualities aren't just sort of in the micro in terms of assessing the personality. They do actually matter. They are actually what we're looking for. Not always, you know, easiest to judge just by the way somebody presents themselves, whether they'll actually follow through in the policy realm. But that, it's not a crazy way to think about looking for somebody to be in charge.
Yeah, and that leadership research, they talk about it as combination of under strength is competence. Like you said, they know what they're doing. They can get things done, have the experience, that sort of thing. And leadership, a little harder to define, but vision, decisiveness, that kind of thing. And then under the warmth is, as you said, empathy. They care about me. They're on my side. And integrity. I can trust them, or not I can trust them. It's they're sincere. There's something about the way they communicate and come across that makes me believe them.
Yeah, that's right. There are a bunch of different ways to articulate and characterize all the different things in each of those buckets. But that feels right to me. The way that I will sometimes do it when I'm working with a client, a communicator, a potential leader, is to take strength and to split it in two. One is basically not just book learning, but skill, right? This person is smart, or they're talented at something. They can get it done. But then the other part is will, which is grit or determination. And that goes sort of more to the, not the vision part of leadership, but the stick-to-itiveness part of the, like, this is my priority, I'm going to make this happen. And it's interesting because linguistically, if you want to portray that you're super smart, it sounds like one thing. If you want to portray that you're not going to be deterred by anybody getting in your way, that's the more sort of Larry the Cable Guy get her done piece of it, as opposed to the polysyllabic, you know, speaking in full paragraphs, I know this conceptually backwards and forwards piece of it, which we all know what that sounds like because we went to school to learn it. So that those two pieces are, I find that that's a useful way to split it up, but there are lots of useful ways to split up all the different things going on in strength, just like how much time you got, in a sense. And similarly with warmth, we feel warmth from somebody who's very personable, but maybe they're just very personable, but not to be trusted, right? And that idea of integrity and how they behave when we're not looking and all of that is definitely a part of what do they actually want from the world? Are they actually on our team or not?
And you apply this in working with leaders, preparing them for speeches and interviews, right? How they're presenting themselves. Tell us about that. Break down, how do you help a leader like many of our listeners apply this thinking to be compelling?
I tend to think about this in terms of the categories we just mentioned, that sure, for sure you need to say and do and be something that projects strength. So the audience, whether it's, you know, the intro, the big introduction and bio that got read out when you were being called to the podium, or something that you do when you get once you get there, or just something that everybody already knows, they need to see attached to you in their summation of who you are and their reaction to you. They need to see the strength and they need to see the warmth on the other side. That I divide into two different categories too, because there's a channel that's what you say, right? So if you want to impress upon somebody how capable you are, you can tell all kinds of bragging stories about this, that, and the other, or, you know, whether it's toughness or talent or whatever, or, you know, you don't have to tell a bragging story. There are all kinds of ways to slip these things in, right? As opposed to projecting warmth, you can think of all the topics that you might talk about to project warmth as well. That said, the talking is limited. The talking by itself is only one of the channels, not only at your disposal, but by which you will be judged whether you use it or not. The nonverbals, the way you carry yourself, so the visual stuff, whether it's posture and gestures or facial expressions. If you think back to our Neanderthal friends, they were not giving big speeches at rubber chicken dinners and like analyzing those, right? It was just sizing somebody up. That's not literally, but anyway, what that figuratively means. And so we each come equipped with this giant occipital lobe back here at the lower back of our brain, where there are literally billions of and I'm not a neuroscientist, so don't quiz me on this too much, but a lot of our brain is devoted to processing not only visual signals, but specifically visual signals about other people. And so, you know, if you think about it, you can tell the difference between somebody whose posture is good or slumped, kind of from across the room, out of the corner of your eye. We do that automatically. And if somebody's here and they're standing up straight and they're looking around and there's a lot of potential energy there, they could engage in lots of ways, as opposed to somebody like this who you're not going to worry too much about, because they're, somebody once said, I think, low energy. And, you know, if you measure the shoulder height between here and here, it's like probably less than an inch difference. But those, we know those things because we are very tuned into that kind of stuff. So it's, yes, there is also an audio channel too. So tone of voice matters a lot in these kinds of things, more so on radio even. But definitely the nonverbal, whether it's the visual or the tone of voice, is just a huge part of how we come away with that impression of folks.
And so that said, a lot of us are sort of, you know, kind of born with these traits. Our voice sounds a certain way. I guess it is on one level, it's how you show up, literally the visual cues, whether you're on camera, on a stage, or standing up to speak. What are techniques folks can use to sort of assess or adjust things like that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Doug. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because it is certainly easier for somebody who is, you know, 6'3", 250, to project warmth or strength, excuse me, rather in the room than for somebody who is more slightly built. But we know that, right? We exist in the world. And so what we as assessors, as the observers in this equation, are trying to figure out is really character, is how does this person operate? And so when we see somebody who's 6'3", 250, right? Tex with the giant belt buckle. Whatever. When we see that, the giant belt buckle might be a giveaway. So let's just say a taller, more muscularly built person. We can see that this is a person who people are going to react to a certain way. Their initial reaction is going to be, oh, physically imposing presence. And so that person then has that person has the option available to them to make their way in the world that way. They have the strategy available to them to kind of show up being physically imposing, and then maybe they can balance that with some warmth. I think of Rosie Grier, who was an ex-NFL player who became a big, you know, children's entertainer star. But they have that strength. On the other hand, I could name names, but I'm not gonna. There are plenty of people in the world who are 6'3", but they got the growth spurt first in their class, and they were sort of embarrassed about it because they were a little shy, and they took to hunching. And maybe they went on and did huge world-changing things in the world and became a great leader, but they still have that. They still show up like a 6'3" tall mouse, basically. And when we see that, yeah, we'll notice 6'3", but we'll also notice that mouse. And so there are ways to dial these things up and down. We don't probably want to dial in mouse, but there are ways if you are shorter, but you show up with your full posture, people know that. That registers with folks. Same with your voice. If you maybe don't have a deep baritone voice, but you are speaking lower in your register, we are attuned to hearing that. And so we can tell, okay, well, maybe that God gave them a squeaky voice, but still means business. And we pick up on those things.
Yeah, and this is sort of things a good speech coach does, is help you with posture and intonation and inflection and all those, what we'd call the performative side of being a leader.
That's right. And it matters. One of the games we like to play with when we do workshops with big audiences is we break down those different channels. And then the kind of one of the punchline questions we ask is, so last time you gave a big important presentation, how much time did you spend on the content versus on all these nonverbal things? And of course, very disproportionately, don't get me wrong, the content is important. What you're saying is important, and words definitely matter. But these other things matter as well. Ideally, you are telling the same story across all of these channels, because if you're not, that actually raises issues of trust, which is why kind of, you know, when we think of nonverbals and people who are nonverbal experts, that's a lot of, you know, poker players and lie detectors and FBI interrogators and those types of people.
Well, let's talk about people we know. Well, here's somebody I don't personally know, but I'm suggested to all the time, Donald Trump, who has clearly won the trust of many people, right?
Yes.
And on one level, and to me, that's on one level, I see, okay, he can convey competence, strength, and he clearly leans into that. I see it more as bullying, but that sort of thing. And then he uses a lot of emotional language when he talks, actually. He talks about emotion. What do you see going on with him?
Oh, boy. How much time do we have for this show? Okay, so first thing I will say is, yeah, this guy, if you think of these strength direction, warmth direction as not just the assessments, but kind of life strategies. Just like you say, bull in the china shop. This is a guy who goes to strength first, right? And he's got the money and the legal team to sue anybody who needs to kind of clean up his messes as he charges through the china shop. When he showed up, I'm a New Yorker. Can I just confess that to New Yorkers, he was always a joke. So I have trouble, but I can see it's very obvious that when he shows up with his name on the side of a plane, who has a name on the side of a plane, right? This is a guy who projected strength in just a massive, almost unprecedented way to a lot of folks that he was talking to in the public. And so, yeah, he had that box checked. Then for him, he's using that strength in a very particular way. It is not warm and fuzzy and cuddly, but he's using that strength in a way that does emotionally resonate with his audiences. And like you say, there's a lot of emotion there. A lot of it is sort of dark and snarly and all of that, but he's going after the enemies of his audience, right? He's like, I'm gonna turn my strength at them, and together we're gonna vanquish the foe. Kind of thing. And that's very appealing. It's very dark, but it's very appealing.
So that for somebody with that mindset sounds empathetic, like he gets me.
He gets me and he's going to get them. That's totally right.
Let's talk about somebody we both know, Hillary Clinton, who you and I have both worked with on campaigns, who really exuded the strength and people saw her competence and leadership. And that was never a question. But in the public eye anyway. She wasn't always seen as warm and empathetic. While those of us who know her and have worked with her find her to be a very warm person who's great to work with. What's your assessment of that?
So, boy, and I remember just the early conversations ahead of 2016 about all the baggage that Hillary Clinton would bring into the race because she had been in the public eye for decades, but mostly when the press was going after her. The press was, you know, trying to create controversies around her and painting her as this very strong but not very empathetic figure, that she was selfish or greedy or conniving or something like that. Now, when she was actually Secretary of State right before she was running, her popularity was through the roof. Everybody thought she was doing a great job. But then, and it is worth mentioning that this does Strength and Warmth do work a little bit differently in terms of how people judge them. Still, it's getting better, but across gender. And so when she, as a woman, was saying, hey, what about me? I'm more ready for this job than anybody else. I'm going to run for president. Almost immediately, perceptions of her shifted in a negative direction. And once again, the press found controversies to generate around her, even though they, you know, turned out to be not a lot at the end of the day, substantively. But that clash, when people would see her in the press, they would see her on the defensive or angrily denying or seeming to be in conflict, as opposed to the Hillary Clinton that everybody who actually knew her in person. You know, we were just talking about Donald Trump a minute ago. And perhaps to many people, at least, the most confusing, legitimately, finding of that whole experience was that people found Donald Trump trustworthy. Not everybody, obviously, but a lot of people trusted him. And that came out in the polls, even as, you know, the Washington Post was counting the lies by the dozens that he was offering, whereas they were not so sure that they trusted Hillary Clinton. And that's a lot in the nonverbals, because for Donald Trump, who is talking in sort of sales talk, he grew up in the real estate biz, and he's saying things that aren't true, but that he would like to sort of will into existence, right? He's very congruent emotionally with his nonverbals when he's saying things that aren't quite true yet, but it's going to be great. As opposed to Hillary Clinton, who knows that when she is saying something in public, it is going to be fact-checked backwards and forwards and sideways, and any possible misinterpretation of her that could seem as not 100% honest is going to be held against her, and she'll be hearing about it for weeks. And what that leads her to do is to triple check her words as they're coming out of her mouth so she gets it just exactly right. But how does that look? Calculated. And if she's not speaking from the heart, we're like, well, what's she doing? Why doesn't she just tell us how she feels? And so that looks more suspicious than Donald Trump doing his Donald Trump thing non-verbally, which is why you get this contrast and a totally upside down assessment of who's more trustworthy.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And that is the conundrums that competent candidates can get in and leaders of all kinds. And as you mentioned, it's well documented that women running for executive office or in executive positions are held to different, higher, double standards than men tend to be. A lot of it is judging this balance of strength and warmth.
100%. And so if you think about it, part of what's going on with strength and warmth, if you think about them as sort of a fundamental pieces of the human experience, stereotypically, at least, guys are presumed strong, right? We come from team strong. And so we, you know, lift heavy objects and open jars, and all of these are rebuttable presumptions, but maleness is associated with strength, and femaleness, by contrast, is associated with warmth. If you want to project both at once, to be a leader, to be charismatic, to be all those good things, for us, we have to not undermine our strength, but we have to add warmth to that. But the way we get judged is if we're a little bit nice, hey, you know, nobody's going to carve our name on a building, but it's like, nice guy, I like that guy. Whereas for women, historically, the kind of catch-22 here has always been, to get to that place, they have to project strength and capability and ability, all of those things. But as soon as they do that, there's a social penalty. And they are no longer being feminine, or they're upsetting the you know, the pecking order, and all of these negative judgments come down on their head and their warmth flies out the window and they get the kind of scarlet B on their forehead. And that's not good. That is changing. Norms are definitely shifting. But, you know, could tell you a little story. So it's a story of research. I guess that counts as a story. There's a woman by the name of Victoria Breskel, a researcher at Yale, who did a fascinating experiment where she had a female head of a sales team basically chewing out her guys for screwing up a big sale, right? So there are guys that report to her. And in one condition, they do exactly what any guy would do with that, you know, regular chewing out. In a second condition, what this sales team leader did was chew them out, but frame and explain their transgression in terms of the harm that it caused to the larger group, that this is not good because it hurts everything that we're doing as a team and organization and all the hard work and et cetera that everybody put it, right? And the reaction to these two different performance was very stark, because when the greater good of the group was articulated as part of that what went wrong, that was seen as a much more socially acceptable female role. It was sort of like a den mother kind of thing. Go back to Oprah, right? And that was okay, as opposed to basically a woman doing a more traditionally male, what the hell's wrong with you kind of thing, which was not well received at all. Now, should we all then, you know, kowtow to these expectations and the sexist expectations around this? That is not for me to say. But it was a fascinating finding and does point to both the resilience of these stereotypes, but also at least one way to navigate around them.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it is an example, evidence that we as leaders and communicators can be intentional, strategic about what we say. That was an example of what you say. And we've talked a lot about how you say it. Those two things matter. But it's complicated. It cuts lots of different ways for lots of different people in different situations. Let's end on a couple tips for people, because it has been a lot. I can imagine somebody listening like, that sounds like a long checklist, right? And I think there also might be a concern about like, well, how am I supposed to be my authentic self while trying to think about all of this stuff?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm so glad you said that, Doug, because the act of coaching yourself on this even is a tricky one, because when you're in the moment, we're saying be in the moment and, you know, express yourself and whatever, but somehow also get all the words right. So don't overthink it, but overthink, right? It is complicated. The thing that I find really useful is the kind of nonverbal piece of this, the getting yourself in the mood to bring both positive, warm energy, but energy and stand up straight and all the rest of that into a situation, is to get in the habit of having a little warm-up routine right before you're walking into a situation where maybe the stakes aren't super high, but where you want to bring your best version of yourself into the equation. And it's almost like I always, I played a little league a long, long time ago, and I almost go really to the on-deck circle for a batter, right? And when you go to the game, the guy who bats third comes out and goes through his, routine and whatever, before he steps in the batter's box or before he's called to the batter's box. And then when he comes out again in the fifth inning, exactly the same thing. And what that ritual or process is doing, yeah, it's stretching your muscles a little bit. And that's very helpful, by the way, because there is a physical component to the energy you bring in. And whether it's, if maybe you can only imagine only manage a quiet, deep breath, like one of these, to stretch these muscles across your upper chest, or maybe you can actually do some pull. I can't really, replicate this, but limbering yourself up, if you do exercise, whatever is familiar to you is really good. So both that physical piece and the ritual saying, okay, this matters, I'm going to set my energy and bring that into this situation. That's very helpful. And also some intentionality about the way you want to approach the particular audience that you're approaching them, Is it you want to be high energy? Do you want to be warm and wise? Is a nice combination of a couple of, you know, there's a form of strength and a literally just straight up warmth in there. So people develop little mantras and getting themselves in the place they want to be, in addition to, you know, whatever checklist of remember to say this, that, and the other thing. But spending a little time getting that energy level and the physicality and the attitude right when you walk into those situations, not just, you know, remembering your talking points, is a useful thing to do. And that critical moment of a couple of minutes right before there is a time you can have a lot of influence on how you come across without overthinking it in the moment and trying to remember to like where your head should go and that kind of stuff. Because you're right, that'll trip you up every time.
That's good stuff. That's very useful. Well, the book is Compelling People, and it's on the reading list of business school students everywhere. And I would recommend it to anyone who's looking for smart insights and useful techniques to be a compelling leader. Thank you, John Neffinger. Great to have you with us.
Yeah, great to be here.